welcome. This is Yuri Rashkin. I'm excited to be joined by two Davids, and that's right there one connection between two topics. And first David is David Cooper, who is a retired Madison police chief. David, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Absolutely. And
then happy birthday.
Thank you. And we're also joined by David Devereaux Weber.
Thank you, Yuri. Welcome to the station, and it's good to be here on our 39th.
It's amazing, you know. And for me, I mean, I am 39, so.
Oh wow, that is.
But my birthday is slightly different. But it's like, wow, this thing has been around for a long time, I guess. Or you know, people look at me and go, well, you're so youthful. So maybe this is just starting out. Maybe,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, that's a good approach.
Yuri, we remember you. You were such a cute baby.
Oh, thank you so much. So why don't we start with Police Chief David Cooper. David, how are you feeling on this this cold, cold autumn day?
Cold. Well, it's a little bit too early for spring, I guess, but we thought we had spring the other day when we were up in the 40s again, but we were shocked.
That's right. I remember spring. That was Friday.
But just remember, we're Wisconsinites. We can take this
right.
Cold. We're tough.
Absolutely. So speaking of tough, and we want to talk about Ferguson. We want to talk about the riots, the protests, the pressure that people feel just living in that community. How do you feel about that?
Well, I feel really strongly about this. I've written, I think, 9 blogs now on my website over the last, since August when Ferguson erupted. My blog site is improvingpolice.wordpress.com, and I've just put an article up this morning, which I've done a lot of reflection on, and the premise is this, that we have got to dismantle the domination system of policing in our country. Now, the domination system I talk about is, first of all, I look at this narrowly, because I'm just talking about police, but the domination system is much, much greater than police. It has to our entire law enforcement system.
And well, it's even bigger. It's in the whole culture. But
well,
yeah.
yes, that's right. That's right. So I'm focusing, you know, what police can do to dismantle this system and start practicing as more democratic, more free society police officers.
I would think that when you look at changing the system on such a large scale, one thing to consider is priorities. What it should be at the top of that priority list, and the way you look at it, David Cooper, what do you see as this should be the top priority versus what it is now?
Well, how we attract, how we attract, select, and train police is certainly, and how we lead them is very, very important, and that's where the first change can come about. That was my experience in Madison. We start changing the kind of people that we were attracting to the organization, then we can get things going on. But the domination system, just bluntly, is that the police are there to take care of one group of people at the expense of another. And that's what we see in Ferguson. But we don't just see it in Ferguson. After Ferguson broke out, the New York Times answered a question that I had right in my mind was, this can't be the only place in America. And I think some 15 metropolitan areas have the same racial disparities as Ferguson did. Mm-hmm. That is basically a community that's changed from being predominantly sort of a bedroom white community. Demographic changes end up a lot of black in-migration, and the police department that was hired and put together to police this nice white community now all of a sudden finds itself being told, well, you've got to do something about those people who are bringing all their problems with them into our community. And the response is, unfortunately, is not to be part of that community, not working with, but to dominate and to use control methods. And the Ferguson is a best example of how we use domination policing right from the start. Just after Michael Brown got shot laying there in the street, in comes St. Louis County's MRAP, SWAT team. You know, not an effort to try to talk and explain, but an effort to show we've got the guns and you don't. And I think that's a dangerous way to police a democracy. And if you want to really know what a domination police department looks like, look at every totalitarian country in the world. Every one of them has designed a well-tuned system to dominate and to control their populations. And I don't think that's the way
Now, Mr. Cooper is not speaking hypothetically here. He was the chief of police in Madison, Wisconsin, and was controversial at that time when using those methods of policing here in Madison, Wisconsin, people thought he was crazy, that he was weak, that he wasn't showing the authority that was necessary to quell the disturbances. Mm-hmm. However, the actions do not reflect that situation. When people responded the way that you had worked with them and trained with them to work, violence was reduced and communications were increased.
Yeah. Well, and if you want to see a domination system, it was Madison in the early 1970s.
That's correct. That's correct.
But we felt that system.
Mr. Cooper and I came to Madison at the same time.
Mere babes.
That's right. And had we known what we know now, we probably wouldn't have done what we did. But the other thing I know you from is as I worked for the cable TV company, and there was a program that was on the local origination that was called Justice, Standards, and Goals with yourself and Bill Ferris, who was the sheriff at the time, and Jim Doyle, who was the district attorney at the time. Yeah. And I was back in the control room running the camera control units, and Bill Ferris once showed me how to forge a check effectively. That was very helpful.
It's not a job. It's a learning experience.
That's right. It's a whole learning experience. And that whole program talked then about policing and justice and how things were handled.
Well, you know, I'd like to put our guest a little bit on the spot because he has touched so many lives. The one question that I have that I'd like to touch on next with Ferguson is my understanding is that their budget heavily dependent on issuing traffic violations. And in fact, I believe over 20% of the city's budget was traffic violations, and over 80% of the police budget was income from those traffic violations, which effectively put more and more pressure on police officers to issue tickets and created that tension situation. How do you feel about that?
Sure, and that's been a danger in this country in the 30-some years that I was a chief of police in two cities, is that there is that pressure. There is that pressure about where this income, you're not writing enough traffic tickets. And there's a lot of communities that depend on that today as a source of revenue. And what we don't look at is, and one of my blogs on my site is, how does getting a traffic ticket get you in prison? Well, the fact is, it can and does to many, right, many people. One of the things is that our traffic fines are now so inflated into all kinds of little add-ons, so that so it might be a $25 fine on the statute books, which after all the assessments are put in could be $100. But the people that get affected by this, the poor people. And I just found out the other day that the European system is when you have a fine in Europe, the basic bartering mechanism is your hourly rate. And you were fined on your hourly rate.
I believe $200. A story actually about that a couple of years ago about a Nokia executive in Finland who got this astronomical speeding ticket because of his income.
That's right. So a physician friend of mine was complaining about the $200 ticket that he got for speeding over on Monroe Street. And I gave him some of the history of Monroe Street and enforcement procedures over the years. But I said, you're lucky. You've got the income to pay that $200. Now, put yourself on a $10 an hour job, working $30 an hour or $30 working 30 hours a week. What impact is that to you to try to get together $200 to pay that fine? So,
right.
I mean, that's how it spirals down, and eventually, someone will be picked up on a warrant. Somebody could resist for that warrant, could get into felony charges, could very easily end up in a Wisconsin state prison.
You know, I served 4 years on Janesville City Council, and the thing that I would like to understand is how can you put people in a position of power, authority, and law enforcement, as we do with our police officers, and yet ask them to remain human beings with compassion and empathy? You know, how do you find that balance?
Well, first of all, they have to be smart, and they have to be educated. You can't you can't just give anybody the job of being a police officer. Being a police officer in a democracy is extremely difficult, but it's also extremely rewarding. You have a lot of authority. You have a chance to do a lot of good. And you can attract educated people to do that. Madison certainly has, and we've kept that going now for almost 40 years now. We've been able to attract persons with educations who maybe are a little older, who have some experience in maybe teaching or in sales. These people are a lot more mature, and it's very easy to start working with them and saying, look, this is the job. This is what you do here. This is how you're to use force. This is how you're to use your authority and your discretion. And you can develop an organization. But even, I would have to say today that even the very best of police departments in the United States are still tied in somewhat to this system of domination and controlling people of color who are poor, who are immigrants, who are mentally ill, who are homeless, who are drug addicted. And I think that's the real test of a great society, is how do we police the underclass and treat them respectfully and with dignity. I think that's extremely important for the success of this country.
Right.
So are you going to put my book on the brow shelf? I mean, I just bought a bunch of books in here for people.
We'd
love to do that. We have several copies, actually a box full of copies of Arrested Development by David Cooper. And can our nation's police be improved? Follow the 7 steps. Certainly looks very interesting and definitely timely. Thank you for bringing these.
But the community did, and I think
there's a lot
strongly.
Of fear when you bring change in, and that still happens today. I mean, I still think that a lot of the reactions that we're seeing today are based on fear because there's so much change going on, and so one of the functions of a community radio station is to educate people on what is going on and how do you deal with change. And one of the things that David Cooper's book really addresses is how do you work with your police department to make sure that they can manage the effects of that change on the community. So in the case of Ferguson, there's a big change in population demographics, and how do you deal with that? How do you deal with the change in income? If you look at the city of Detroit, because of the loss of the automaking industry and all those factory jobs, Detroit is totally different than it was 30 years ago. And the way that cities earn revenue, the forms of revenue for cities is usually property taxes. Well, when you've got huge property vacancies and abandoned properties, then your revenue goes way down, but you still have the same number of square blocks to police, and you still have the same number of miles of water pipes and sewer pipes and streets to patrol and everything else. And so revenue down, yet demand still up.
You know, I guess I'd like to get a clarification on that, because my understanding was, at least in in Janesville, we dealt with obviously some foreclosures, and the property loss of tax revenue wasn't from property taxes wasn't as much of an issue, because somebody always owns the house. If it's not a person, then it's a bank, and somebody has to pay property taxes. So they weren't as concerned there about the revenue that might be lost from the foreclosed properties. But maybe that's different. Maybe it's different in Detroit.
In Detroit, they had abandoned properties, so no one was paying taxes. But, Janesville is a different situation. Janesville underwent the loss of the big General Motors plant. That was the huge...
Who? What? I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah. So, when that kind of a thing happens, property values either don't grow as fast or actually decline because the earning potential in that whole community goes down. In Madison, we've lost factory situations with Rayovac and Gisholdt and Oscar Mayer and so on that have had reductions in workforce compared to the 60s and 50s timeframes. So, but that happens to most communities as time goes by. Change happens.
Well, and then there's a cycle. And I kind of wanted to go back to David Cooper being, a regular frequent guest on Ward back in the, like you said, early days, because one of the things that, I learned from Structure of Scientific Revolutions is that until people feel that the current solutions are no longer fixing current problems, they're not going to be accepting new solutions.
Sure.
And so it sounds like having that conversation and communication approach really helped to develop understanding within the community that there is a problem that is not being addressed by current solutions, and so new solutions are needed.
Sure. Well, and if we take a look at the Ferguson situation, I mean, most white people have very little contact with police. So having no contact, they see images of police and they think, well, fine, I mean, they're not bothering me. But when you go into racial minority communities, it's entirely different. They've had a lot of contact with police and overwhelmingly negative. Mm-hmm. And then we get, even in Dane County, the recent race to equity report, and we've got some serious, serious questions that need to be asked within our community. How long can we, now it's been a good 40 years, how long can we continue to permit an educational system in which young black students in high school are not graduating, and about to a rate of about 40 to 50% are not graduating on time? If we ratchet that back to employment, when we talked about early childhood things, it's a very devastating situation. Yet, in this community, we have tolerated that year after year after year. And what was the old quote I heard? We're a racist society without racists. Because no one ever claims to be a racist. Yet the things we do seem to have a very negative effect on a significant population in our country.
And a different effect based on your racial heritage.
Exactly, exactly.
You're listening to Public Affair. This is Yuri Rashkin, and my guests today are David Cooper, retired City of Madison Police Chief, and David Devereaux Weber.
When my children were in primary school, my wife and I participated heavily in the parent-teacher organization. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we had a really hard time with was how do we get parents of racial minorities to attend parent-teacher organization activities at schools. And the problem is that there's a certain percentage of people who are single-parent families where that parent is working two jobs or two and a half jobs and doesn't have an hour, even if you give them free pizza, to come to a school event. People just are overworked, and their time budget is stretched way over too tight. So those are the problems that we have to solve, because without that kind of family involvement with the school, then the student doesn't feel the connection and doesn't have that good feeling about continuing the education. And if they don't feel that they will succeed by getting an education, there's no incentive for them to finish. So how do you bring that incentive system together to... Because it doesn't just help that person, it helps the whole community. It helps in a more safe community, a more prosperous community. So it helps everybody, not just the individuals affected. I mean, that's one of the problems when people talk about taxes. Well, those aren't my children. No, but it's your community. That's the problem. It's everybody's community.
You know, Dave, I can't argue with that, and I think that for me, probably the main takeaway point, and that's something that I notice over and over, is people work too darn much. You know, we placed ourselves and created our society around ourselves that we perpetuate every day, where we work as much as we can, and then it leaves us time for nothing else, and even things like politics become very, very something that people don't have time for, because you got to do this other stuff just to put food on the table. And the community suffers.
That's right. That's people making decisions about whether or not they're going to run for the school board, whether or not they're going to run for city council, those things. Well, I'm too busy. I can't. And many people, that is true. You know, they're working, you know, two 20-hour jobs a week or three 20-hour jobs a week.
Go ahead, David.
Yeah, one of the things I talk about in my book and on my blog is the coercive atmosphere of many police organizations, that the police officers themselves are not listened to, are not respected, are not treated justly. And how do we expect them to go out in the street and treat other people in the way in which we'd like them to? When we look at police training, over half of police training academies in the United States say they use the stress method. And the stress method is translated to being sort of like Marine Corps boot camp. So having been a Marine and having gone through Marine Corps boot camp, I can assure you that it's got nothing to do with how to become a good police officer. But nevertheless, the officers who are beginning to be trained are demeaned and taught to do kind of like stupid kinds of things and having to do push-ups and the usual boot camp routine. When I write about it, people say, "Well, it's a stressful job," and I say, "Well, yes, I'm for job-related stress. I'm for shoot, don't shoot situations. I'm for having scenarios and breaking up a domestic situation. I'm into scenarios dealing with a mentally ill person." But the whole atmosphere of the academy should not be coercive. And maybe it's in the many ways the domination system touches all of our lives.
David, I have a question for you, and I should mention that you have a blog, www.improvingpolice.wordpress.com. I had a really kind of an interesting experience on Friday morning being on a Moscow radio station, appearing because I speak Russian, and I had somebody actually from the radio station.
Хорошо, очень рад.
Очень рад, очень приятно. And they called me and said, "Would you please be on our radio program, talk about Ferguson?" And I said, "Well, I'd be delighted to." So, you know,
конечно.
I did some конечно. And I did some research and, you know, just to kind of sound a little bit, you know, to kind of figure out what is interesting to listeners over there and everything. And the one thing that they were trying to figure out, and I'm curious to know what you think about this, David, is they were trying to figure out the riots and protests. You know, first, of course, is like America coming to a close? Is this the end of capitalism? You know, whatever. But the other part is this racial or is this economic?
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Is it racial or economic?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And what do you think? Is there a fine line? Is it all kind of mixed together?
I think yes. Da. So, yeah, I mean, I've talked to some of those Russian stations. So, you know, one thing you might know, back in college, I was a Russian language major.
Oh, прекрасно.
Много лет.
But the question about the end of capitalism is not just a fluff question. It's a really important question, and it's because of the
sure.
changes that we're seeing that are going on.
Sure.
Yuri is sitting in front of one or two computers here on the table, and I've got a phone in my pocket that's got a computer, and
yeah.
everybody is touched by these things. There are fewer platinum records today because fewer records are sold. And as a result, that kind of change is happening in a number of areas. And so how do you value something? How does the stock market value a stock? Because manufacturing automobiles is or turning out CDs or records isn't what it used to be.
So can we afford to have throwaway people? I mean, if people don't contribute to our system, then it's okay that they get to languish in poverty. Their children don't get health care. There's not jobs. There's not eventually housing. Is that the product of a full capitalist society? And do we have any responsibility for our brothers or sisters? I mean, I think that's an important question today for us.
It is.
I am excited to be joined by the former Madison Chief of Police, David Cooper, who has a website, www.improvingpolice.wordpress.com, and he's also author of a book, Arrested Development. And I'm also joined by David Devereaux Weber. So, David Cooper, would you tell us a little bit about your book?
Well, the book came about some years after I had retired because I thought we were on a continual increase of improving things in America, and was called back to a national conference after I'd been retired for a number of years, and it was to talk about Jim Collins' new book, Good to Great, why some companies make it and some companies don't.
That's a great book, actually.
Yeah, it is a good book. So what I found is my colleagues, when they had gotten there, I came to the conclusion that they hadn't read the book, nor were they interested in talking about it. So on the way back, I made some notes and kind of set them aside. You know, what is it that's blocking and what are the obstacles American police have? And I developed four of them. It's mm-hmm. a general feeling of anti-intellectualism. Formal education isn't important. We don't need to know what's going on with research. The only thing that's worth doing is that's what we do. We can't learn from anybody else. Second was just too quick to use violence in resolving problems. And we've seen this year after year in how we are responding to standoffs with mentally ill persons, in which they are usually always terminated by the death of the mentally ill person. I don't think that can go on any longer. We've got to figure out other methods in which to handle this. The third was corruption. Personal corruption in terms of false reports, false testimony, organizational corruption and hiding and secrecy and not being open to the public. And the final was the general attitude of discourtesy towards other people. Some people feel just disrespected by the police whenever they contact them. And of course, that's based on your race, on your age, on your class.
You know, some of these things, they sound similar to, I think, what you would encounter when you have a monopoly. Because when you control the market, how worried do you need to be?
Well, that's right. That's right. So we've sort of stumbled into this style of policing, though some of my colleagues tell me America has always used domination policing in how it's policed its cities. This is not new. But since Ferguson, I think it's become very, very aware. And I think the Internet has made a big difference in the fact that we know so much more about things. We see hundreds and thousands of contacts. Put Ferguson, Missouri into your web browser, and my gosh, you've got hundreds. Going on YouTube, put police violence, hundreds and thousands of them. Cameras either from police cars themselves in shooting incidents or citizens who have taken their camera out.
Yeah.
They've alluded to being arrested because many places throughout the country in the last year have started to move away from that, but citizens were actually arrested for filming a public police incident.
All right, we have a caller. Please state your name and the reason for your phone call.
Dennis. Not to harp on the negative, but, you know, you brought up the issue of violence and police work, and, you know, I sympathize with the officers. I mean, who seriously, you need a real, something to want to do this job in the first place. But, you know, beginning with the Rodney King incident, I'm just amazed that nets haven't been brought back into the picture. There was an issue in Muguanago, and I can't remember how many years ago this has been. It could be as many as 10. A young man was schizophrenic. Lifelong member of the community, diagnosed at 19, 29 years old on a summer's night. He's out wandering around with nothing but a shirt on a new home construction site. And the two officers involved tasered him 12 times, resulting in his death. And that's one particular one where I'm just amazed that a grand jury found the officer, acquitted him, and he went on to become police chief of Muguanago right now.
You know, Chief, I have a question for you because Officer Wilson is leaving the police force. He
yes.
says he can't be a police officer.
No.
Do you think that, you know, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that is one thing that I don't think police understand. I mean, it's in my experience, every officer that I've ever worked with that has been involved in taking another person's life has really not done too well for the rest of his career. I think when police choose to use deadly force, they are leaving a piece of themselves behind there. Yet the culture is such that, oh, this is a good shoot. This is okay. You were justified in doing that. In the situation in handling mentally ill people in standoff situations that have like small knives or something, shooting somebody and taking their life is not the only way. I expect that we would do some thinking about this, like the caller Dennis just said, something about nits. In fact, Patrick Murphy, commissioner of New York back in the 70s, suggested that they were going to do this, but I've never seen any account of that ever being used. But it is one strategy. The military has developed something called sticky foam, which you literally encase a person in foam who's got a knife and who is who is acting in a very violent way.
There you go. That was a good sticky foam.
That was good sticky foam. But, you know, there are ways to think about this. Instead of putting police officers in the situation of having to take a person's life because they think that's the only option they have in their,
so
bag.
So, just to kind of trying to find some use in every hour, if you are talking to police officers and you're talking about big institutional changes, are there some things that you would advise police officers, for instance, or everybody else who is not a police officer, that one thing that they can do to improve the situation that they individually can do?
Well, as I've told people for years, that when they get angry about the police, I said, you can never change them from the outside. If you want to change the police, you join the police. That's what I did. I mean, when I was a police officer on the street, I said, there's got to be a better way to do this. I didn't like the way we were doing business. So I'm going to go to school.
So like an activist stockholder.
Well, yeah, that's right. So what I would say to one thing to a police officer is become educated. Understand the big picture. Know how systems work. Because it's that kind of knowledge that allow them in one day when they get into a leadership position to make a difference.
Great.
I mean, we can't have narrow-minded, short-sighted police in this society. They're dangerous to themselves and they're dangerous to other people.
Thank you, David. Well, thank you so much to my wonderful guests, David Deborah Weber and David Cooper. David is author of Arrested Development, and also David has a website where he blogs about police and other things, www.improvingpolice.wordpress.com. This is Yuri Rashkin.